I'll record the Adderall and I'll press record here.
Recording in progress.
Recording. Greg, good morning, and it's nice to see you again.
Good morning, Russell.
I'll just introduce the interview as we did before, just for time and place. So this is the second part of the interview with Dr. Greg Johnson, who's being interviewed for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection and the ACT Monero Riverina branch. The interview is taking place on Thursday, the 1st of February, 2024, and Greg is at home on Ngunnawal land, and the interviewer, Rosalind Burge, is in Lilyfield in Sydney on Wangal Gadigal lands. We're much more conscious of incorporating those Indigenous landscapes into our conversation.
Yes.
Greg, it was intriguing as I finished up your transcript from your previous interview. There seemed to be some elements of your conversation and your interview that could have been expanded. One element I know is particularly important to you at the outset is family. Perhaps you'd like to just talk a little bit about that.
Yes, well, you know, family is important, and I think that all that I do nestles within the warmth and the love of family. And in the interview, we talked about some of my ancestral connections. And that's one aspect of the importance of family, and it's something that I guess you learn about a little bit more as you go through your life, but it's sort of like means plus genes, you know, it's the memories plus what you've inherited genetically. And, you know, when I reflect on my own life and the lives of others, I think that I've been fortunate to have had supportive and encouraging parents, but if you like, not interfering parents. And also, of course, my wife, we've been married for 42 years and together for about 46 years. And we have both synergies of interest, philosophical values and love. You know, and there's always those elements of companionship that sort of accompany you through whatever you're doing. I guess that adds to the enjoyment. And we're also fortunate to have two sons, and they're enjoying both thoughtful and conscientious lives. And as a child, I moved around a lot. You know, some people have sort of grown up in the same place, lived in the same place. And so my friends always seem to be somewhere else. But they're still important to me. And I value that the warmth and those connections, even though they're sometimes very distant, particularly from working a lot overseas. You know, some of my friends are in different parts of the world. But there's always this sort of waking up that comes with your conversation, and then, you know, I think those sort of formative experiences, like going to university, where you sort of leave home and you begin to discover yourself much more.
Did your parents go to university?
I know. My mother probably left school at the end of primary school. This was, you know, in the Depression years. My father was fortunate because he grew up in Maryborough, and the grammar schools became state high schools just when he was finishing primary school, and so he and my uncle were both able to go to high school to what we call grade 10. I forget what it's called in other states, but a sort of, you know, until he was about 15, and they were definitely, they probably had more education than any previous ancestors, at least back a couple of generations anyway.
Yes. And when we met again, I don't want to go too much into this, but on this interview, but your connections to your ancestors from very different parts of the world. You spoke about your Chinese connection and a little about your Scottish connection, which also seems to be important to you.
Well, yes, I guess it's, you know, when you have an interest in gardening and you discover you've got a whole host of gardeners in your inheritance, and the ones in Scotland, of course, they have very good records, and so you can find lots of references to them in the press and on maps and other places. And we're going to Aberdeen in May, June, and I hope to explore some of those things.
Just to Aberdeen, or are you going elsewhere?
We're going to Edinburgh, Aberdeen, Inverness, and of course we'll also be in London for the Chelsea Flower Show, but Aberdeen and Edinburgh are sort of looking at ancestral places.
A very productive trip for you.
Yes, it's right, it should be fun.
Your career, Greg, covered extensive overseas travel as well. But what for you is the principal role of scientists? That's a very big part of your life.
Well, you know, I think that scientists, the principal role, of course, is to expand knowledge and understanding of the world and the universe that we live in. And in my case, of course, it's understanding more about plant diseases and, you know, and the science that sits behind that. And sometimes progress can be incremental. Compared to, say, the 19th century, early 20th century, when it was just such a whole wide open field. You know, we do make progress by standing on the shoulders of giants, but also, you know, of course, since the late 80s, the whole field of molecular biology and understandings of genetics has just been able to create much greater depth of understanding of science. Certainly not something to be feared. It's certainly, you know, it's just the framework on which we can build, I hope, better futures.
And your work, particularly one of the roles that you said you were very proud of your achievements, was in your work on mangoes.
Well, yes. I guess, you know, the focus came into mangoes because, you know, that was the particular task I was given, but the elements of that work, I know I gave a talk once where I said that for every 50 papers, scientific papers published on wheat, there's only one published on mango. That means that the knowledge about mango as compared to wheat is expanding only at a much slower rate. And yet the problems for the individual farmer are just the same. And so it means that the work that, say, has been done on mango, it's really important that there is great synergy and coordination so that the work that's been done in any part of the world dovetails in and you're not wasting effort and time doing the same things. You know, that's the importance of collaboration. And it's not a matter of, you know, oh, they're going to steal our results, because, you know, our results often are built on their results anyway. Because modern agriculture is in ways, it's a little bit disconnected from nature. It's also important to get a better understanding of the ecology of the systems we work with. That includes both the plant pathogens and the hosts, in order to, you know, make the best effort we can to reduce problems.
Most of us are living in cities now, in Australia particularly. You say it's separated from nature. Is it? Are we also separated from where all these things come from. I think people can relate more to a mango than a grain of wheat.
Yes, that's right. We are separated. But of course, you know, I guess modern farming systems are trying to place more emphasis on, you know, having a great systems approach, having more living soil, you know, many of the things that are important, and also in relation to plant pathogens and insects, going back and understanding, well, what were the natural controls of those problems in the places where those plants came from? And of course, we've seen a lot of progress in that with insects, where they bring in biological control agents. The best example in Australia, of course, is controlling the prickly pear by bringing in a cactus that ate the prickly pear. But there's been, you know, many approaches to that, and you know, we see it also in human health, where there is the understanding of the microbiome, the microflora inside people's bodies that can be imbalanced and therefore affect their health.
Yes, much more part of general conversation today.
Yes.
Also, throughout the interview before, Greg, and throughout the notes that you've provided, there's a strong discussion of teamwork, of collaboration, and you've mentioned colleagues who you work with proudly, and perhaps you could touch on that for me.
Yes, I think teamwork is important, and particularly, I guess that was my experience in the early days, and even in studying at Oxford University, where you learn a little bit about many different things, including geology, soil science, biochemistry, entomology. And then when it comes to working on a crop, there's a team of people, because it's no good for the plant pathologist to say, or spray with this chemical, when that chemical kills the predators of that insect. And so, you know, working as a team, and you would work as a team with extension officers, working on mangoes and other fruit, you also have to understand the whole change in storage environments, because how the product is stored can determine how quickly it ripens. Because in nature, if you take a mango, for example, mangoes have a sap, and that sap basically stops fruit flies from attacking the mango, stops plant pathogens from invading the fruit until the fruit ripen. And when the fruit ripen, those systems begin to deteriorate, and the insects and the diseases invade. But what research has shown is that there's ways of subtly managing that system so that you have just a little bit more edge to reduce the disease while the fruit ripens. And of course, the classic example we a lot know of is avocados, where, you know, they're not ripe. They're ripe and then they're rotten. We have to get that tiny little window when they're soft and ready to eat. And if we leave another day, it's decayed. And some of my research in that team with plant physiologists, fruit storage experts, was really about understanding what is the optimum for all of those processes to delay ripening, delay disease development, but also maximise flavour and quality of the product. And, yeah, that's, I think, very enjoyable, working in teams like that. There's a lot of trust involved. There's a lot of sharing. And in one way, it's impossible to understand and achieve the result you want unless you work in a team. But it's like in, surgery, you need more than just the person doing the cutting. You need a whole host of people doing all sorts of jobs in order to achieve success.
True, but I must say I can't look at mangoes in quite the same way ever again after this interview, thinking of the mechanics, not only the science, but the mechanics of delivering it to my dining table. But also through your work with ACR, could you tell me about that, the Australian Centre?
I think that in the 80s, when it was established, there was the idea of working with partner countries, helping them to improve their agricultural systems, but also solving problems that were existing for Australian farmers. And that whole idea of, knowledge occurs in increments, and let's work together with our partner countries to solve the problems together. Sometimes we've been able also to work on a problem in another country we don't have in Australia. And one of the most serious diseases of citrus, which is called Huanglongbing, which is Chinese for yellow dragon disease. It's also called citrus greening. We don't have that disease in Australia, but we have been able to work in other countries to try and get a better understanding of how can we manage that disease if it comes here.
So do the countries come to you with issues, or you go out seeking them?
The way in which ACR has worked is they have a policy advisory council which consists of representatives from partner countries. And of course, being a government authority, it's also, I guess, aligned with, political systems of our country and those partner countries. ACR would have priority setting meetings with those partner countries so that there was an agreed agenda, because it's no good a country may say, we'd like you to work on this thing or that thing. But if we don't have any body of expertise in Australia to work on that particular problem, then it's not one that we can really address, and it may not be a priority for us. In the case of mangoes and tropical fruit, all of the research in the 80s, 90s occurred when our own industries were beginning to expand. And partner countries were also beginning to be more market-oriented. So we worked on mangoes, we worked on lychees, longans, durian, many different tropical fruit, developing just the basic understanding of, what are the problems in those crops and how can we manage them and how can we store them better.
Is there one field of endeavour that you were more favourable about or more keen to return to? In those overseas ventures?
Of course, my work with ACR began as a researcher in a collaborative project and moved on to leading a project on behalf of the agency, the Queensland Department that I worked for, to then subsequently working with ACR. So there was two phases. There was a phase in which I had that big focus on mangoes and tropical fruit. But then when I started to work for ACR, I worked more broadly in both promoting the importance of post-harvest research and coordinating our research in a broader range of topics. Because often there isn't an understanding, particularly amongst many scientists. The scientists are very production orientated. They just want to work on better production, plant breeding, whatever. Not recognising that maybe 30% of the loss occurs after harvest. And so, sure, we can have great systems to produce wonderful products, But then if 30% of that product is damaged or destroyed, all of that effort in producing it is wasted. And so from when I started working in that post-harvest area, part of my time was spent educating and encouraging both my agency and the funding groups of the importance of post-harvest research, and to explain, give them a basic understanding of why it was important.
How was that received? And,
well, sometimes it was difficult. It was, could be energy sapping, because, you know, sometimes people don't have the use for us and they're very focused on their own other agenda. You know, an international agriculture research generally is very focused in production areas, in production systems. There's emphasis on that post-harvest. You know, another example, for ACRs, we had a program started by my predecessor, Dr. Bruce Champ, in the 80s, on stored grain management and pest control. That whole area of stored grain management is so important in Asia, you know, where food, of course, is important. You know, the Chinese, the Indonesians adopted many of those management systems to do with, well, how do you dry the grain bread better so it doesn't rot? How do you control the pests without using too many chemicals? You know, food security is so critical for them. I think one of the lasting legacies of that whole period with ACR was that improvement in stored grain management. In my own time with ACR, I was also able to encourage investment in research on cocoa and coffee, both the whole process of cocoa fermentation, cocoa disease management, cocoa drying, working particularly in Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. In the case of Indonesia, we also had partnership with the Mars Company. Mars, of course, international American company. And when it comes to cocoa chocolate, you have two types. You have the bulk cocoa, which provides the bulk of the body, and then you have the flavour cocoa, which is partly produced by the fermentation process, and a lot of the cocoa that comes from Papua New Guinea of particular varieties and management processes has wonderful flavour. Similarly with cocoa, with coffee, we, you know, those of us who love coffee know that where the coffee comes from, the environment, the climate, how it's handled, can influence its flavour. And of course, these are important commercial factors. But there's a lot of public research that needs to go on to improve those systems.
You mentioned listening. I'm sorry, Greg. You were continuing.
One other thing I want to talk about was in the case of peanuts, where from the 1970s, there was very close attention in Australia to managing the aflatoxins, which are aflatoxins are a type of toxin produced by fungi, and many mycotoxins or fungal toxins are maybe 50 times more toxic than pesticides. And so Australia had a system where in Queensland they would measure the level of that mycotoxin in every single load of peanuts before it was unloaded. And if there was a level that was considered dangerous, that those peanuts would be processed in a different way. And so within ACR, we were also supporting various initiatives to improve management of mycotoxins, particularly aflatoxin in peanuts. We're fortunate, of course, that if you like, the evolution of marketing has reduced those risks because it's easier now to prevent peanuts from getting wet after harvest, drying them properly, and storing them in supermarkets is much better than storing them in, you know, a wet market in Indonesia.
There are complexities beyond measure in your work. But it must have been very exciting to have gone on these trips overseas and returned to Canberra and had these conversations with colleagues.
Yes, and certainly it was exciting in a way, but often the trips were relatively short. I was rarely away for more than 2 weeks with a very busy schedule. And, you know, there has to be a degree of focus because often when you visit a country, your hosts want to entertain you. They want to, you almost do anything, to make sure you're happy. And, so there has to be a measure of discipline by you as an individual when you go somewhere to say, look, if I see everything the first time, there's no reason to come back. Sure, it would be nice to do that sightseeing, but let's stay here and talk about the work instead. I think I probably went to China for, I don't know, more than 10 years before I moved into the Great Wall in Beijing, because there just wasn't the opportunity. My colleagues in other programs within ACR were similarly travelling, so it was a shared commonality we had.
I wondered, you mentioned going to New Guinea, and you also mentioned a long journey you had in Bhutan. Is there one country that stands out for the physical challenges it posed in your work?
Most of my travel didn't really involve very much physical challenge. Because you were representing Australia, you were well looked after. But I was travelling a lot to Pakistan, where we were fostering and supporting a multi-pronged project that had both mangoes, citrus, dairying, social aspects over 10 years from starting in around 2006. And in those early visits, it was safer in Pakistan. We were able to go to Peshawar, for example. But in later years, it became more dangerous. So the security was tight. We weren't allowed to just go wandering around. But I always felt safe because, of course, the government and the partner country really had everything in place to make sure that visitors were looked after. Going to Bhutan as a consultant, when I worked as a consultant for my own business, we travelled by road the length and breadth of the country looking at citrus. Some of the roads are basic, but the driver's always very good. And you only really have glimpses of, what people go there to see with sightseers. I know once some of my visits to India, I guess, were perhaps the more challenging. Usually the biggest challenges that I ever encountered were food poisoning. But I learnt how to reduce the risk of that.
How do you do that? What's your secret for travelling?
Well, I think when it comes to food poisoning, you've got to realise that you can't just turn on the tap and clean your teeth, for example. You have to use a bottle of water even to clean your teeth. And you don't eat fresh greens. You may love eating salads at home, but much of Asia, that's just something you don't do, and even eating cut fruit, avoiding the cut fruit. Sometimes on particular airlines, I would be very careful not to even eat the cooked food. To reduce the risk because, when you're there for a short term with big responsibilities, you can't necessarily afford to be not available.
Of course. Greg, may I ask what prompted you to start your own business?
I guess that was, that was serendipity in a way because my position in ACR was a contract position. The priorities of the agency changed and I didn't really want to go back and work for a department. And there were the opportunities to work as a consultant in the same area of development that I had worked in before. I was fortunate to have those opportunities, both helping in the implementation of some ACR projects, some projects funded by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade through what was formerly AusAid. But also, doing other things, for example, an FAO project in China that was relatively short-term visits, advising on a kiwi fruit disease problem. But similarly, the opportunity to go to Bhutan came through my person who moved to ACR after me, connected to an ACR project. And of course, some of my work subsequent to leaving ACR was also to be reviewing projects and programs that ACR was funding.
You just mentioned FAO. Just for the record, what does that stand for?
Well, FAO is the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. They, of course, are very involved in addressing priority issues for their partner countries.
You've made a large number of connections and links with individuals across so many realms of your work with the FAO and with the ACR. Do you maintain those links or have they, in retirement, slid away?
Certainly I maintain some of those links. Of course, the beginning of all those links really begins from when you begin work as a researcher, because when I started work as a researcher, if you wanted a copy of a paper, you would send a little postcard requesting a reprint and they would post it to you. And you would have identified that through the literature that came into the library. My 20 years or so of research, I had a base of connections and expertise in my own field of planetology, both in Australia and in other countries. And that really was part of what I took with me when I became more involved in development. Some of those people, I've kept connected with for many years. Similarly with some of the farmers that I worked with coming out of tobacco research, then into mangoes. Some of the farmers have gone out of tobacco and into mangoes. Some of those industry leaders were people that I've kept connections with. Some of them passed away, but it may just be a Christmas card every year, but there's still some connection with those people. I think that one of the outstanding features or one of the outstanding aspects of what ACR does is that many of the Australian scientists who've been involved with their work give much more for the dollars that they're getting funding, because they maintain those connections for 20, 30, 40 years, both in the sort of personal interactions, because like everything, there's not only the research, but there's also the encouragement. You know, there's the answering questions, there's providing advice, suggesting connections, all those things that happen. And I've just seen time and time again that the people in Australian research projects have maintained those links for many years. And that's sort of very subtle diplomacy by Australia in a way. But they're the people-to-people connections. Very important.
Speaking as someone who reads the paper every day and sees a whole lot of political actions happening, you never see any of these sorts of conversations or interactions happening internationally. There's a whole scope for another interview, as well as for many theses, I'm sure, on the role of development agencies and agricultural agencies and other agencies in Australia, and the opportunities that we could have across our immediate neighbourhood.
Yes, I think that a lot of that is going on. There's a lot of, there's even a lot of sociological research into these various agencies. But as you say, it doesn't necessarily make the news. You only see glimpses of it, usually when there's a human dimension, like, the Australians who went to Thailand to help with the cave rescues. You might necessarily see the Australian, who went to, a colleague of mine went to Afghanistan before all of the, the last 20 or 30 years of conflicts. He went there to advise them because the potatoes were being frozen. He wouldn't be likely to go back again, but right back into the 50s and even the founding of those international agencies after the Second World War, there were Australian advisors going to different places advising on particular problems. Our culture is much more focused on sport and the arts, I suppose, than on the science. We see glimpses, but that's all. In a way, people, I think, who do research are happy just to get on with what they're doing.
Does it frustrate you that there's not a greater interest and emphasis?
Well, I think that, yes, it is frustrating. There's many more examples of philanthropy in other countries. I know, just as an example, in South Africa, there's been some philanthropists who, have funded for many years some of their agricultural research. Philanthropy in Australia has got a good strong focus on human health research, but there's much that philanthropy could do for agricultural research. There's examples also in the UK where there's research institutes funded by philanthropy in agriculture. Maybe our state system detracts in a way, but any philanthropists ever listen to this, perhaps they could think about agriculture a little bit more.
Perhaps that's your next career, guiding them. And speaking of that international connection, you were very deeply involved in the International Society for Plant Pathology, which was established in 1968. When did you join?
Well, I guess I joined the, when I started work 50 years ago this year, I became a member of the Australasian Plant Pathology Society. And the Australasian Plant Pathology Society was a member of the International Society for Plant Pathology. So I automatically became a member of that society. The International Society for Plant Pathology represents about 60 societies around the world, national and regional societies of plant pathology. And In total, that means it represents about 26,000 plant pathologists around the world. Plant pathologists have a very important role in society, but it's perhaps under-recognized. And from when I became a consultant, or even before that, when I worked for ACR, I was able to become more involved in the International Society. I became the Secretary General, and then the President. And I'm the only Australian so far who has been a head president of the society. As president, from 2013 until 2018, and I continued on the executive until last year. So I was involved in the executive through the period of COVID. I oversaw the initiative which my predecessors had begun to give more emphasis to food security, and that had been inspired by Norman Borlaug talking to the International Society in 1998. We established a journal published in partnership with Springer Nature on food security.
You initiated that link, didn't you?
I was really part of the executive that oversaw the beginning of that. But the role I played, because I was the Secretary General, was to scrutinise more carefully the contracts. And we had a contract in which we initially owned half of the journal. But last year, under the terms of our contract, we could acquire the other half of the journal for complete ownership. We still publish in partnership with Springer. The advantage of publishing with someone like Springer is you have a global reach. You know, the topic of food security, of course, in that period has become more and more important. And the income that society earns through a share of the publication income gives the society more independence financially, and will allow the society to continue in the future to fulfil its major roles, which are to promote plant pathology throughout the world, and also to convene the International Congress of Plant Pathology every 4 or 5 years. That can be a major meeting of, you know, 2,000 plus people, scientists. I forgot to say earlier that that importance of building networks also very much comes through going to conferences where you talk about your work, you hear about someone else who's doing something similar, and you build a network of contacts that strengthen what you do.
Those social events are invaluable in that score. But it must be very difficult. Just think about the Australian Garden History Society's conferences. They must be almost a piece of cake compared to organising an international conference across so many fields.
Well, yes, of course, Garden History Society conferences are small, limited a little bit in number because of it being linked to garden tours, where there's always a limit on the number of people that can visit. But of course, when it comes to organising an international conference, you know, there's many more people involved. You know, many teams of people. Usually you have professional congress organisers. You know, you have the congress facilities. Many challenges, but many hands make light work. And for me, you know, some of the memorable opportunities working with the International Society included the, I think I could mention my colleague from Italy, Professor Lodovica Galino, who is a tower of strength and energy when it comes to organising meetings. And she organised the wonderful congress in Torino. And then I was very much involved working with our Chinese colleagues for the congress in 2013. that involved visits to China, Beijing, talking about the scientific program, putting together bits and pieces, working out teams to develop technical sessions. Of course, our Chinese colleagues also had, you know, capacity and energy to organize all of the practical aspects of the conference. I think it was a great success for them. Then in 2018, when I was president, we had the Congress in Boston. That was also, a great meeting, very much aided by the American Phytopathology Society. But I suppose I took great pleasure, particularly in organising the opening plenary, which consists of three speakers from different parts of the world, including a colleague from Australia. We had hoped to have a colleague from Papua New Guinea go as well, but she was unable to work through the challenges of getting to Port Moresby to get a visa.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the end, she didn't get there. And of course, one of the legacies of the COVID period is learning about and beginning to hold meetings by Zoom.
Yes.
So we do have Zoom connections now, and of course, my most recent experiences working for the International Society came about because of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and for the Congress in Lille, we organized the session. You could say I really, helped inspire it rather than organized it. The session was called War on Conflict and Plant Disease, and we had some experts and people from both Ukraine, but also Syria and Africa, who talked about some of the challenges of dealing with plant diseases and horticulture in times of war. That was, in a way, it was a great honour to be in any way involved with them and to attend the meeting in Lyon, where some of the speakers from Ukraine were able to attend in person, but of course some couldn't, some spoke by video. The title of one of the speakers from Ukraine's talk was Keep Calm and Grow Plants. And that session is available and can be listened to online.
Is that the first time that the Society has had a seminar section on food security?
Food security has been a strong feature of our congresses right from the very beginning. The very first congress in 2000, in 1968, the keynote speaker was about food security. But since the late 90s, we've had a task force on global food security, currently led by Professor Lisa Corsten from South Africa. And that is really continuing, and that was inspired by Norman Borlaug, who challenged our society to put more effort into that area. What was different in Lyon last year was that we had a session on war and conflict and the impact of those things on disease. And one of the speakers was Dr. Safar Kumara from Syria, who worked for one of the international centres. And she commented that this was the very first time she'd ever been to a conference where the issue of war and plant disease had been discussed. She's sort of famous because of the role she played into creeping back into war-torn Syria to rescue some of the seed collection belonging to the International Centre for Agriculture Research in arid and dry areas. And she talked also about the losses and the challenges of rescuing or saving seed collections countries where natural disasters such as hurricanes have damaged their country's collections.
Mm-hmm. In all those stories you read, that's not part of the story. The general person reads in the paper. Is that going to be something that the society is going to consider regularly, that question of war and food security?
Well, I guess that remains to be seen. We would hope that the topic becomes less important over the years through the breakout of world peace. But
that's a nice hope, Greg.
But within that program, of course, International Society also initiated a system of bursary support at the time when the conflict in Ukraine broke out. Some of the women scientists and others with men, for example, with physical problems or disabled children, fled to Poland to escape the conflict. And we work closely with our colleagues in Poland to provide short-term support for some of the scientists to continue work in research. Some of them went on to get support from other bodies. Many other sort of agencies began to also support research for these people. Mm-hmm. And, that will become, I guess, a permanent legacy of that period. We will, we hope to be able to provide bursary support for emergent situations. We went on to provide support for a couple of students who were affected by the earthquakes in Turkey last year.
And of
these
course,
things, of course, depend on resources, but it's an ongoing need to be able to just step in when you have to and provide some emergency support.
And just going back to your conference in Boston, what was that session that you were very pleased to have presented?
It was the opening plenary, and I think the topic was Plant Health is Earth's Wealth. And we had speakers with, diverse backgrounds. I know that my colleague from Australia was the third speaker, and his topic was, whatever the question, chocolate is the answer.
Who was that speaker, Greg?
His name was Professor David Guest from the University of Sydney. And he talked about his work in Papua New Guinea, working with colleagues in PNG and East New Britain and Bougainville, where it's recognised that one has to have a One Health approach. That is, not only think about the health of the crop, but also the health of the community, and take a farm-family approach to extension. That is, talking to both the men and the women. A project that David led involves also human health specialists from the University of Sydney. And so there was also attention to human health. Often it's not recognised that it's hard for a farming community to implement disease control measures because the humans in that community aren't well enough themselves. Whether it's through illness, disease, conflicts, lack of food, lack of vitamins, there's many things that need to be thought about.
How's that program succeeding?
I think that it's been quite successful, and I know that our most recent report from ACR talked about how some of that work has been extended to the Solomon Islands. Of course, the whole idea of farmer field schools has also been strongly supported over the years by the FAO in our program for ACR working in Pakistan, the Agriculture Sector Linkages Program. Our sociological team from the University of Canberra were working both with the men and the women identify opportunities to improve livelihoods, but also to extend agricultural information.
Huge field.
Taking awareness of cultural sensitivities and the cultural systems of that country.
A lot of complexities to work together with.
And of course, it's not that the Australians do everything. It's the whole partnership model for ACR is that it is the partner country scientists who lead and play an important role in that work, because they continue that work long after we've left.
Absolutely. So just going back to your time as president of the society, there must have been many highs and many challenges, but are there a couple of examples that stand out in addition to the plenary session?
Well, I think, establishment and purchase of the journal was obviously something very important, but also in this period, my colleague who was treasurer when I was secretary general oversaw the registration of the society as a charity in the USA. We've tried to enhance the professionalism of a society, which is not always easy when you're basically depending on volunteers, scientists who have other jobs. It's building the connections. It's engaging with scientists. I know that the whole conflict in Ukraine led to me working a lot with the Polish scientists, for example. It's great when you engage a country or society in that work so that they become more involved. They get more out of their membership. The other thing that the International Society is responsible for is the awarding every 4 or 5 years of the Jacob Erikson Medal. This is a gold medal. It was from a fund established in the 1920s. And it's a little bit like the Nobel Prize for Plantology, I suppose, because the scheme, it is administered by the Swedish Academy of Science, and the International Society has a role in overseeing the selection of the recipient of that award every 5 years or 4 years. In recent years we've made an effort to make that, make the processes more equitable. We've also worked to encourage both our congresses and the executive more diverse in representation. This can be a challenge, but it's important when you're working with societies representing many countries to have both, gender balance, if you like, and representation from at least the 5 continents.
We're much more conscious. Yes, much more conscious of these.
Yes, and sometimes when it comes to the congresses, of course, resources are limiting because, in many countries there is the challenge of getting resources to bring people to the congress. You've got to start somewhere, and we're fortunate that some of our societies and the countries where they are based recognise the importance also of helping to bring people to congresses.
Mm. How did you feel when your term as president came to an end?
Well, I guess, I think I've said before, planetologist always it's like a life task, but for my term as president, of course, I served 5 years as immediate past president, and so there's a long goodbye, you could say, and even now I'm still involved in some ways, both in providing advice to the incoming executive. I would hope to go to at least the next Congress, which will be on the Gold Coast in 2028. The connections there are, of course, something that I have to fund myself, but, it's just one of those commitments of the life.
Mm. So you have other interests beyond that in your own garden, just continuing those threads. Your own garden interests. So what has been the role of gardening for you?
Well, of course, you could say gardening is the reason why I'm here because, it's been an interest throughout my life. It's something that is innate. It led to my career path. But the opportunity that has been here for me and my wife living in Canberra has been, to have lived in the same garden, in the same home for 28 years. So that you can plan a garden. I guess my gardening approach is a bit like my research. There's a lot of, and the way some people do art, there's a lot of intuition involved. It's not, I'm not an amazing true gardener. Living where I live, of course, we had many mature trees. Our home and garden are more than 50 years old. And so there's a legacy. But you can see many changes, transitions over the years. Being in one place and in the period since I've become consultant, I've also been able to invest more time in professional interests such as the society, but also in, the interest that began in my childhood, which was growing unusual plants, propagating things, growing things from seed, living here in a cool climate like Canberra, I can grow the bulbs that are from cold and mountainous countries in Europe, particularly fertile areas, and my primulas, they're two species or two genera I'm interested in.
Why are you so keen on those?
Well, I think that, the thing about many of the bulbs, cold climate bulbs, the advantage is they die down over summer. And so you don't have to worry about watering them over summer. Some of the primulas also die down. They're easy care for the environment that we live in. And whilst, if you could say, for example, tulips began, being interested in Europe from, even in the 17th century or earlier, some of the genera like fritillarias really are only beginning to come into cultivation. Some of them, of course, the species come from what was the former Soviet Union, other parts of the Middle East, mountainous areas. And so the sort of work that began with the Dutch, with tulips, 300-400 years ago, is only just now beginning with things like fritillarias. And so in 100 years, perhaps we might see many more of these, well, in our rose-red rare bulbs, much more widely grown, in the way that people love to grow tulips.
Did you import them?
New things.
I can see that. Did you import them, or are they that new?
I didn't import them. There's some societies that have seed exchanges, and each year for the last few years, I would be getting seeds in seed exchanges from the Scottish Rock Garden Club, the Alpine Garden Society, the North American Rock Garden Society. Those seed exchanges also occur within the monitoring constraints of Australian quarantine systems. You know, you're only bringing in varieties that are approved and there's inspections involved. But my interest really began because of the efforts of earlier collectors and importers, such as the late Marcus Harvey from Tasmania. Marcus was a great collector and grower of many unusual bulbs. There is a book available which is a record of some of his adventures in bulb collecting. And he used to sell bulbs by mail order and also seed, and he encouraged me to try growing them from seed. There are other, the late Brian Tonkin is another early grower of bulbs from Victoria, and his daughter Jane Tonkin still operates Tonkin Bulbs, and you can buy commercially from her some of these rare and unusual bulbs. And here in Australia we have the Alpine Garden Society Victorian Group, and they also promote seed exchange and also encourage cultivation of unusual plants.
And you're a member of that, or you're yeah. very pleased yes, to be mentioning that clearly.
I'm a member of that, and it's really a subgroup of what was the Alpine Garden Society in the UK.
Perhaps it's a project for the 50th anniversary of the Society to see how many garden societies of different interests there are around the nation. You start scratching the surface and it becomes a genealogical tree, never ending.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think the Alpine Garden Society Victorian Group might have celebrated 30 or 40 years last year, so they've been going a while.
So, just thinking about your general garden interests, Greg, you also mentioned that you'd attend the Australian Landscape Conference. Why does attending that appeal?
Well, the Australian Landscape Conference began, I think, in the 60s or 70s, always in Victoria. I first started attending maybe 10 years ago. Organised most recently by Philip Flannery and based here in Yass. But the Australian Landscape Conference will involve one day of visiting gardens and 2 days of talks. The very first conference, I think it could have been in 68, involved a whole host of these famous and eminent gardeners from UK, including Christopher Lloyd and other well-known gardening celebrities or writers. And Christopher Lloyd spoke at the National Press Club. You can listen to his talk online. And one of the questions that came from the press was, what do we think of an Australian garden? He replied, I haven't seen one yet. He was very much coming to see
And in fact, I'll come back to Christopher Lloyd when we talk about Cedric, but just finishing your landscape conferences.
Yes, so, they're enjoyable. They have always been in Melbourne. Because of the, bringing in exciting international speakers. There's usually an optional day of visits to gardens. It's held at the Melbourne Convention Centre. So it's just a couple of days of talks, meeting people that you know who come to the conferences similarly. Fleur is moving beyond just the conference every second year in Melbourne, and she's having two events this year, a series of speakers at an event in Sydney, and linked to that is the half-day event here in Canberra, bringing out some eminent gardeners from UK.
I think it's called Outland or Outlandish.
Outlandish is the name of the first company, yes. Mm.
And how does the focus of those, the Landscape Conference, differ, say, in generalities from the Australian Garden History Society?
I think the focus of the Landscape Conference is the focus is on modern gardens, you know, the focus is on gardening now, rather than necessarily being a focus on history. And of course, there's a much stronger international dimension, you know, there's been speakers from India, speakers from Japan, China, giving modern perspectives on landscape. And there's probably a more emphasis on landscape design rather than necessarily gardening per se.
Are you going to go to the Outlandish one?
I'm going to the event that's in Canberra, the half-day event.
So coming to the Australian Garden History Society, and just touching on Christopher Lloyd and Cedric, I was going to ask you, you're smiling. You know Cedric is a very, well, obviously he's no longer with us, but a will-o'-the-wisp and a very enthusiastic garden person. And you knew him, and you were also very instrumental in helping me with the interview. But he also talked about Christopher Lloyd.
Yes. Of course, Christopher Lloyd would have been one of his inspirations, I guess. Cedric, of course, came to Australia in the 50s, and he also studied landscape design under another well-known designer, whose name I can't remember.
We can add that in later.
Yes. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to visit Christopher Lloyd's garden in UK, Great Dexter, which is now managed by Fergus Garrett. Christopher was a wonderful entertaining writer, I guess, as well as having a interesting, exciting garden.
So tell me about your role in the society in Canberra.
Well, I guess that, you know, I began to become involved in the local management committee first couple of years after I joined the society in 2010 or 11. And as a member of the committee, often you can be overawed by the knowledge and experience of your fellow committee members, and you know, you contribute ways that you can, and so I became involved initially in preparing the talks on Australian garden writing early Australian garden literature, which was an interest I had. Over the period of a few years, I gave four talks on various periods of garden writing. But I then moved on to helping organise some events, starting with a walking event through New Acton here in Canberra, where we both spoke to some of the chefs in that area who were using and growing some of the foods around their restaurants. Then organising some of the speaker events. The one that I guess sticks in my mind is a more recent one, during the COVID times where we had Jason Chong from Melbourne talk. Jason has the background from Timor-Leste, but he's well known amongst young gardeners for his advocacy relating to indoor plants particularly, and he has and operates his partner, the Plant Society, based out of Victoria. It was just an initiative to reach a broader audience of our society.
So is the society... Sorry, after you, Greg.
So, and of course also during 2020 we initiated the photo competition. Also, Helen Page from the Victorian branch had similarly conceived the idea, and we ran the photo competition over 2 years. We didn't get a huge response in terms of numbers, but it was interesting to do. We were fortunate to have the artists, Lucy Culleton, Tricia Dixon, two photographers, Doug Spauer and Victoria Cooper, as the judges of that competition. And we had a wonderful prize winning entry by Matt Magnum McCready of her grandson launching mid-air with his lawnmower with her lawn.
Lovely photo.
A little bit of text to go with it. It was a fun thing to do. I leave the opportunity for others to enjoy that fun in the future.
Is there much interaction with the other branches, as with Helen Page?
There's a little bit of interaction, particularly when you have, for example, gone to the annual conferences and you get to know people in other branches. As a member, of course, we also see in the regular newsletter from the National Office events in various places. I've been to and spoken at events in the Southern Highlands and Sydney, that is in relation to my garden writing talks, and also in Melbourne of the Victorian branch. But I've also been to some of the one-day seminar events for the North West Southern Highlands branch. I've just taken the initiative myself to be on their mailing list so that I can keep tab of what opportunities there are to go to other events.
What is the health of the society right now, do you think?
I think the society is healthy. We have we have active, engaged branches organising lots of interesting activities. There's always the regular worry about ageing membership and the need to continue to engage and involve younger people, newer people on committees. But a society we're going okay. I think that if we lived in a world where horticultural history societies received a small slice of government largesse when it came to funding, it would allow those societies to be more active. When it comes to, if you think about sport, and if you call gardening a sport, then perhaps gardening would be the sport that involves most people in Australia. And if we take the health angle with gardening, the importance of gardening as a measure to keep people active as they get older, then there's all sorts of reasons why our governments, from local government to national government, think a little bit more about providing financial support and other support for these little endeavours by groups of gardeners.
I wonder if that's a your next advocacy project in the ACT branch.
Perhaps, yes. You know, having said that, of course, we're very fortunate just to have Gardening Australia and the ABC, and I know that the ABC radio will have gardening programs right across the country that engage and involve gardeners. There can be much more. I know that when I've been in the UK attending the Chelsea Garden Show, for example, for the whole week you can turn on the television and there'll be television coverage of what's happening at Chelsea. I answered a questionnaire about live streaming of sporting events, and I added a footnote suggesting that they could think about live streaming the Chelsea Garden Show.
Good luck.
It might be something that I would actually be interested in watching.
Yes, but I think that's a very strong start to your next advocacy. But speaking of advocacy, Greg, the society also punches above its weight, particularly the branch, your ACT branch. You've had a number of issues that you've had to fight for.
Yes. Well, that's true. And we've been fortunate to have, over the years, had members who have had strong professional roles in history, conservation, advocacy, to help underpin a lot of that advocacy work. And even now, our local branch member, Anne Chloe Long, is a professional in that area, and she can help to add clear thinking to those submissions.
Anne's on the National Management Committee. Has that, joining the National Management Committee, been something that you might think about to fill the void from your ISPP?
It's not something I would think about. That's because I guess I've spent 50 years being involved in those ways very professionally. I think it's always important to give the opportunity to other people, and maybe just be more focused on family and personal interests.
You mentioned your involvement with the journal before and your association with that, and I meant to ask you one name that's cropped up a couple of times in your writings. I'll just dip back into your professional world and come back to the society, but is Brian Deverell. He was involved, wasn't he, on the journal for your society?
Yes, so Brian Deverell's wife, Laura Deverell, is a member of the Garden History Society, Sydney branch. And Brian was a professor of plant pathology at the University of Sydney, but he was also the newsletter editor for many years, until he unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But Brian was a stalwart proponent and regular producer of the newsletter of the society. Has been published every month since about 1972.
Month.
That's distributed nowadays, of course, online, free to everyone, anyone who wants to receive it. Our current editor is Daniel Uberley, who is in West Australia.
I'll just pause one moment to stop the editor roll, and I'll come straight back.